In many ways, Singapore is a pretty small country. Out of all of the 195 UN member states and observers, Singapore is ranked as only the 176th largest country in terms of land, with only a handful of tiny microstates who are smaller. With only 736 square kilometers of land, Singapore is smaller in land size than even New York City is. But, just like New York is, Singapore is a very densely populated place, and it's really the only true functioning city-state that exists today in the modern world. There are roughly 6 million people who call Singapore their home today, which is large for a city, but still pretty small for a country. Singapore's population would still only rank it in 113th place on the same list of the UN's 195 members and observers, with an amount of people that's roughly equivalent to Denmark. Within its immediate geographic neighborhood in Southeast Asia, Singapore was once pejoratively referred to by its much larger neighbors as the Little Red Dot, a tiny independent nation that was surrounded by giants. On a physical map, you can barely even notice Singapore amongst its peers unless it is explicitly highlighted and pointed out for you. And even when adjusting for a population-weighted map, Singapore's size of people still pales in comparison to all of its neighbors. Its immediate neighbors, Malaysia and especially Indonesia, have orders of magnitude more people in their countries. And other than the very tiny Brunei, Singapore has the smallest population in the whole region of Southeast Asia. But when you look at Singapore through a different kind of lens beyond geographic size and population, with an economic lens, Singapore will suddenly appear as a relative colossus, especially in relation to its smaller physical and human sizes. Through this lens, the little red dot is no longer so little. And that's because with a nominal GDP of $548 billion as of 2025, Singapore is astonishingly the world's 26th largest economy today, ranking its economic size far, far higher up in the rankings than its geographic and human sizes. To put this into perspective for you, the Singaporean economy these days is roughly the same size as Thailand's, a much larger country that is home to 11 times as many people. Singapore is in fact the 10th largest economy on the entire Asian continent when excluding Russia, despite it being only the 36th most populous country in Asia, which means that Singapore's economy is larger than all 25 of these other countries in Asia who have a larger population, including some notably very large countries like Pakistan, Bangladesh, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Iran. Perhaps most interestingly, Singapore's economy today is significantly larger than Malaysia's is, its immediate next door and much larger neighbor. And Singapore is the second largest economy in all of Southeast Asia behind only the gigantic Indonesia. However, despite Indonesia having a giant population of 274 million people, a whopping 45 times more people than Singapore has, the Singaporean economy is still about 38% the size of Indonesia's economy anyway. Consequently, as you'd expect, the Singaporean GDP per capita today is absolutely insane. As of 2024, it stands at an incredibly impressive $89,000, and ranks Singapore with the fifth highest GDP per capita in the entire world, remaining only behind Luxembourg, Switzerland, Ireland, and Norway, and putting Singapore even ahead of the United States. And perhaps even more astonishingly, Singapore's GDP per capita is now significantly higher than what is seen in the United Kingdom, their former colonial era overlord. The median wage in Singapore also currently stands at an impressive $46,000 a year, which is also higher than the median wages that are currently seen in the United Kingdom, that stand at only around $44,000 a year in comparison. Singapore has also emerged today in the 2020s as the fifth largest concentration of the world's wealthy people, with more USD millionaire residents than anywhere else on Earth other than New York City, Tokyo, San Francisco, and London. With a current millionaire population of around 240,000 people, roughly one in every 25 people who lives in Singapore today is a millionaire, among the highest ratios of wealth seen anywhere in the world today. And according to the Global Financial Centers Index since 2023, Singapore has managed to position itself as the world's third most significant global financial center, remaining only behind New York City and London, and outclassing every other city to be Asia's leading center of finance in the 21st century. This is all what makes Singapore among the most overpowered countries relative to its physical and population sizes anywhere in the world. But it wasn't always like this for Singapore. And Singapore's current gigantic outsized economic power and influence is in fact only a very recent phenomenon, and it was never guaranteed to have turned out this way. Only 20 years ago, back in 2004, the Singaporean GDP per capita was only half of what it currently is today. And just a little further back in history to the country's independence in 1965, only 60 years ago, the country was deeply impoverished and its GDP per capita was even lower than contemporary countries like Jordan and South Africa, that both remain relatively poor today. Back then, just 60 years ago, Singapore's GDP per capita stood at only a paltry $511. The country's unemployment rate stood at a high 14% of the labor force, half of the population was considered to be illiterate, 70% of the population lived in hopelessly overcrowded conditions, and around a third of the population were squatting in slums. Singapore had zero natural resources of any kind to offer and had zero natural freshwater resources to sustain its population of what at the time stood at about 1.86 million people. And yet, despite these humble origins after independence, in only the 60 years of history since that time, within the span of a single human lifetime, Singapore went from those unlikely beginnings to becoming one of the most fabulously wealthy, successful, influential, and developed megacities on the planet. And it transformed itself into what I would argue is the most overpowered country relative to its physical size located in the whole of Asia, if not the entire world. And in order to understand how Singapore got to where it is today and how it managed to pull off what's arguably the most radical societal transformation ever seen in human history within a single person's lifetime, we have to go back a bit further into history and then build back up to the present. For most of human history, the island of Singapore was basically a sparsely populated village until its geographic potential was realized by Sir Stamford Raffles, a colonial official of the British Empire. He managed to secure control over Singapore in 1819 and turned it into a British colony, and into what is known as an entrepot, an intermediary port where goods are brought to from elsewhere in order to be collected and shipped off somewhere else. Raffles and the British both understood Singapore's strategically valuable location directly along the Strait of Malacca, the shortest maritime trade route between China and the East and India and Europe further to the West. Singapore was built up as a free port by the British during the colonial era, meaning that there were no taxes or customs duties imposed on ships and merchants doing business there, which, combined with Singapore's strategic location between the East and the West along one of the world's most valuable trade routes, caused its population to quickly begin soaring, as merchants and traders from across the region and from across the world all sought out their fortunes there. As a result, Singapore developed throughout the colonial era into a bit of a cultural melting pot, with large numbers of ethnic Chinese, Malays, and Tamils from India all settling there. While the ethnic Malays were the indigenous community of Singapore and of Malaysia, by the early 1960s, when the colonial period on Singapore was starting to come to a close, about 75% of Singapore's population were ethnic Chinese residents, due to the past several decades of trade and migration patterns under British rule, while only about 15% were ethnic Malays and the other 10% were ethnic Tamils who had come from India. This made Singapore a uniquely Chinese-majority and ethnically diverse territory at the tip of the Malay Peninsula in Southeast Asia. And save for a brief period between 1942 and 45, when it was occupied by Japanese forces during the Second World War, Singapore was continually under British colonial rule from the time of Raffles' arrival in 1819 until a century and a half later in 1963. After World War II, though, as the British Empire entered into a period of sharp decline and collapse, the British granted Singapore a significant degree of autonomy and self-rule in the 1950s, which ultimately led to a local election and the rise to power of a man named Lee Kuan Yew as Singapore's first prime minister in 1959, who would go on to prove himself as one of the most incredibly competent statesmen of the entire 20th century, and who would become the man most singularly responsible for the incredible direction that Singapore would ultimately take after it became independent. Lee understood well that in the era of decolonization, Singapore was a small, impoverished, and resource-poor island located in a geopolitically dangerous neighborhood. As a result, Lee initially believed that Singapore's greatest odds at survival were going to be through a merger with the other British colonies in the region, which at the time consisted of Malaya, North Borneo, and Sarawak. Malaya gained its independence from Britain first in 1957, and then it united with North Borneo, Sarawak, and Singapore in 1963 to form the modern country of Malaysia that we know today. But Singapore's own membership within Malaysia would ultimately be very short-lived. At the time, Singapore was the most heavily populated state in Malaysia, and though it was geographically small, it already made up 20% of Malaysia's total population. As such, the political and economic influence of Singapore within Malaysia was very large for its small size. And unlike the rest of Malaysia, which had a majority ethnic Malay population, Singapore had a significant majority of ethnic Chinese residents. Ethnic, political, ideological, and economic tensions between Singapore and the Malaysian central government quickly mounted. And despite each of their previous assurances not to do so, Lee's People's Action Party, or PAP, based in Singapore, and the United Malays National Organization, or UMNO, from the mainland, both entered into each other's respective political spaces, which sparked significant race riots in Singapore in 1964 due to the UMNO's support for affirmative action for Singapore's minority ethnic Malay population. Then, fearing the Lee and the PAP from Singapore would gain more influence in central Malaysian politics, and fearing his own loss of power and influence as a result, Malaysia's then Prime Minister Tunku Abdul Rahman made a curious and highly unusual decision. He decided to just expel Singapore out of Malaysia against their will in 1965, only 2 years after they joined to form Malaysia, which left Singapore as an unusual country in history that did not declare or even seek out their independence, but had independence forcibly thrusted upon them. To most Singaporeans at the time, the expulsion from Malaysia was viewed as being effectively a death sentence. The country's future was deeply in doubt and uncertain, and there were almost countless problems that seemed insurmountable to overcome. Singapore was a small and overcrowded island home to more than 1.84 million people. They had no available room to build out into, and the infant country was rocked with high racial tensions between the various communities who call the island home: the Chinese, Malays, and Tamils. Singapore had never been its own country at any time in the past throughout all of human history, and it was entirely a product and legacy of British-era colonialism, meaning that there was initially no sense of patriotism or common identity to keep the country's population together. The unemployment rate stood at about 14% of the country's labor force. Around half of the population was considered to be illiterate, and a third of the population were squatters and slums that had been built out on the fringes of Singapore. The country had absolutely zero natural resources of any kind, including any freshwater resources. It was cripplingly dependent on water imports from Malaysia, the country that had just kicked them out to be on their own, and it had to import virtually the entirety of their energy resources from abroad as well. Their infrastructure was still heavily damaged by the fighting of the Second World War, and to top all of those problems off, the British Navy, which had once been the main driver of the island's economy with their major naval base there, had already fully withdrawn from Singapore after it had merged with Malaysia and was no longer there to offer any further economic aid. Singapore was left on their own with all of these internal problems and a hostile Malaysia immediately to their north, along with an aggressive and potentially expansionist Indonesia immediately to their south, both of whom had vastly larger populations and resources available at their disposal. Little wonder, then, that most Singaporeans at the time believed that their ejection from Malaysia was a death sentence, and hardly anybody back then could have ever predicted just how spectacularly Singapore would overcome all of those formidable odds that were stacked up against it. But Singapore's greatest early strength was its strong leadership through Lee Kuan Yew and his PAP. Shortly after Singapore was ejected from Malaysia, much to Lee's dismay, his resolve to keep Singapore alive and thriving despite the odds was summed up when he was quoted as saying, "In a world where big fish eat small fish and where small fish eat shrimps, then Singapore must become a poisonous shrimp in order to survive." End quote. An early foretelling of the often fanatical survival instinct that was forced onto Singapore, and which became a deep part of the new nation's psyche and culture right up through to the present. Other than that sheer will to survive, Lee Kuan Yew and the early PAP knew in 1965 that Singapore really only had two other things going for it. One, from an international trade perspective, Singapore enjoyed an immensely strategically valuable location directly at the entrance to the Strait of Malacca, the trade route that represented the shortest possible maritime distance between China in the east and Europe in the west through the Suez Canal. And two, Singapore's dense urban population and human capital. Lee understood that without any natural resources and with their very small geographic size, the only way that he could get the country's economy moving was by attracting as much foreign investment into Singapore as physically possible. And in order to do that, Singapore's entire society needed to be radically transformed into what would essentially be a mega corporation's dream state. And so, the PAP's decades-long strategy began, carefully molding Singapore into a country that was almost run like a corporation would be. And just about every single decision and policy that the government would make going forward would be done in order to keep Singapore as the most attractive place on the planet for international companies to invest in. Corporate and personal income tax rates were both set to be among the lowest anywhere in the world, while business regulations were reduced to being so minimal that Singapore has often been ranked throughout the 21st century as literally the easiest country in the entire world to conduct or start a business in. At the same time, labor unions in the country were strictly regulated. They were required to be registered with the government, while potentially destabilizing activities like striking were strictly limited or even prohibited. Public protests of any kind were almost entirely outlawed. And there would be no change in leadership or ideology under the constant guiding hand of the PAP. Lee Kuan Yew would ultimately go on to govern Singapore as the nation's leader for more than three straight decades until 1991, while his PAP has continually remained in power in Singapore ever since the country's independence for the past 60 years up until the present day. Democracy was therefore limited and restricted in Singapore in the name of ensuring permanent stability and predictability to foreign investors, who were looking for a safe place with low taxes and regulations to park their cash in. And throughout 60 years of continuous, uninterrupted, one-party rule in the country, the PAP has truly been free to just get a lot of things done, and they've been able to continually pursue their master plan of development without any political interruptions. To further project Singapore's image of an ultra-attractive, stable place to invest in to the rest of the world, the PAP also introduced an effective zero-tolerance policy for corruption. They combined a system of extremely harsh sticks to penalize corrupt government officials, including executions, along with extremely generous carrots like very highly paid salaries, in order to discourage government officials from ever being tempted to engage in corruption in the first place. On top of that, fearing that crime and drug use could become another source of instability that could discourage foreign investment if it was left unaddressed, the PAP also adopted a harsh, tough-on-crime approach to governance as well. Most notably, Singapore has remained into the present day as one of the few countries remaining in the world that still routinely carries out the death penalty for convicted criminals, especially for drug traffickers. If you've ever flown into Singapore, you'll be handed one of these not-so-subtle warnings by your flight attendant before your flight arrives, because the only penalty under Singaporean law for smuggling drugs into the country is execution by hanging. Over the past 3 years, between 2022 and 2024, Singapore, despite its small size, was among the top 10 countries in the world for the numbers of legal executions that were carried out by the state, and virtually all of them were executions related to drug trafficking. This has earned Singapore a large amount of criticism from abroad, and has led to some derogatively referring to the country as Disneyland with the death penalty. But the goal of these PAP policies in Singapore over all of these years has been clear. There would be continuous political stability. No protests, no crime, no corruption, low taxes, low regulations, and a very pro-business environment to attract as much foreign investment into the country as physically possible, so that Singapore would not only survive, but also thrive, in combination with its very strategic geographic location. And while many of these policies that Singapore adopted were harsh and considered anti-democratic, the PAP government also calculated that the Singaporean people themselves wouldn't really so much mind living within a soft autocracy with limited political rights so long as they remained happy and continued getting richer. So, Singapore essentially began adopting a system of carrots and sticks for its own people, to disincentivize them from ever partaking in protests, crime, strikes, or other destabilizing activities that could disrupt the sweet flow of foreign investment, just like it did with its system of carrots and sticks with its government officials, to disincentivize them from ever partaking in corruption. After its independence, the Singaporean government used its powers to buy up around 90% of all of the land in the country for below market value. And then, it created a new government agency called the Housing Development Board, or HDB, to begin building massive new apartment blocks to address the country's housing shortage and overcrowding problems. Lee Kuan Yew once wrote a letter in which he argued that the government's promotion of widespread homeownership was the best way to give everybody who lived there a true stake in the country's future. And in Singapore's specific case, it was going to be a great way to meld the diverse population of the island's Chinese, Malay, and Tamil populations, who had no prior history of unity or shared nationalism, together into one unified whole. HDB would go on to build around 1 million apartments in Singapore in 24 towns dotted around the island, while ethnic quotas mandated that each HDB-built apartment block reflected the ethnic makeup of the overall country at large, in order to foster a sense of community and oneness between them. The Singaporean government was then able to promote widespread homeownership in the country by selling the HDB-built apartments for 99-year leases at rates that were below the market value of what full-on permanent indefinite homeownership would be. As of 2024, the average price for a 99-year lease on a 2- and 3-bedroom HDB apartment in Singapore runs at just $237,000 and $359,000 respectively. And then, to make them even more affordable to first-time homebuyers, the Singaporean government also offers a grant to lower-income buyers of up to $59,000 that they can deduct from the overall home value. On top of all of that, the Singaporean government also implemented a mandatory savings program managed by a new government agency that they called the Central Provident Fund. This program made it mandatory that Singaporean workers always saved 20% of their monthly salaries at a minimum. And then those workers would be allowed to draw those savings down in order to use as a down payment on an HDB-built apartment. And then they could use what remained of their mandatory savings to make some or even all of their monthly mortgage payments as well. As a result of this whole program, Singapore has managed a homeownership rate that is the envy of the world today. 88% of the country's total housing supply today is directly occupied by their own owners, which is far ahead of the vast majority of the rest of the developed world, and is significantly higher than the rate seen in the EU, the UK, the US, or Germany. And it is a strategy that has earned the governing PAP an enormous amount of goodwill and loyalty from Singapore's citizens. And it's not even the only way that the government has taken care of them either. To maximize the value of the country's human capital, the government highly emphasized education and it managed to build out a truly world-class public education system that prepares children to become highly educated, highly skilled, and highly paid workers that'll attract global businesses interested in their talent. The government also went to great pains establishing a world-class healthcare system as well, that keeps the country's citizens and foreign workers alike healthy and productive, and perhaps more importantly, happy and less likely to resort to destabilizing protests or strikes or votes for different parties. And in combination with the clusters of HDB-built apartments and population density concentrations, the government worked alongside both public and private companies to build out a world-class public transportation system at the same time that put transit stations directly in every HDB-built apartment cluster, which directly connected all of the apartment clusters together with each other and with a central business district in order to maximize transportation efficiency and minimize congestion in a brilliantly executed master plan that is spanned over decades of time under continuous PAP leadership. The government also deliberately made driving a car in Singapore outrageously expensive, both in order to promote the use of the country's public transit system and to reduce congestion within the country's small physical space, but also to reduce the country's consumption of fuel and overdependence on foreign imports of fuel, since virtually all of Singapore's fuel has to be imported from abroad since the country has no resources of its own. Various taxes and permit fees on vehicle ownership in Singapore make it so that even a new standard Toyota Camry hybrid costs around $183,000 in the country today, about 6 times more expensive than one would cost in the United States. As a result, only about 1/3 of households in Singapore own a car at all today, while the vast majority of the country's residents use the cheaper and more efficient public transportation system. 80% of Singaporean households live within just a 10-minute walk of a transit station because of the way the system was designed alongside the HDB apartment complexes. And 85% of public transit journeys in the country under 20 kilometers in distance can be completed in less than an hour, which results in Singapore's infrastructure and workforce both being extremely efficient. which attracts more foreign investment into the country, reduces the country's overdependence on foreign imports of oil, and which also further keeps the population happy and satisfied, in combination with all of the housing, education, and healthcare benefits that reduces the odds that they'll ever protest or riot or vote for someone else and disrupt the PAP's master plan. All of these policies were carefully crafted in Singapore to keep the whole country thriving, happy, stable, and humming, in conjunction with Singapore's inherent geographic advantages to trade and commerce as well. Among Singapore's greatest strategic geographic advantages was that at the time in the late 1960s, its time zone was placed in between when markets in America closed and when markets in Europe opened on the following day. Singapore's position in between these markets enabled the country to fill in the gap in global trading hours, which led to Singapore's establishment of the Asian dollar market in 1968, that had the explicit purpose of bridging that gap in global trading. And that became the foundation for Singapore's modern banking and finance industry. It also didn't hurt that Singapore's port was just placed in one of the most fantastic spots in the entire world, too, which is the whole reason why the British originally turned it into a colony and a trade outpost in the first place. It sits precisely at the southern tip of the Malay Peninsula, with a commanding position at the entrance to the Strait of Malacca, the shortest possible maritime trade route between East Asian countries like China, Japan, and Korea in the east, and the oil and gas-rich Persian Gulf and the large consumer market of Europe in the west. As a result, an overwhelming amount of the oil and gas imports that flow towards China, Taiwan, Japan, and South Korea all move through the Strait of Malacca right by Singapore, while an overwhelming amount of Chinese manufactured goods flow in the opposite direction through the Strait of Malacca on their way to the consumer market in Europe as well. Because of this dynamic in the modern world, roughly a third of all the world's crude oil and natural gas traded by sea passes through the Strait of Malacca, which makes it the most highly concentrated choke point for the global oil and gas supply anywhere on the planet. Roughly 30% of the entire world's global trade will pass through the Strait of Malacca every single year. That's worth approximately $3.5 trillion. And so from very early on, independent Singapore carefully positioned itself with all of its business-friendly policies to be the go-to spot for handling and processing these huge trade flows between the East and the West. In terms of overall trade volume, until it was finally surpassed by the port of Shanghai only in 2010, which has left Singapore as the second busiest port in the world in terms of overall trade ever since. But Singapore still remains the number one busiest port in the world in terms of transshipment, and so their port is critically the biggest transshipment hub on the planet. Transshipment is the process of sending trade goods to an intermediate destination first, then transferring those goods from one ship to another ship, or from a ship to a plane, or from a plane to a ship, and then sending them on their way to their final destination. Because of Singapore's strategic location directly at the most critical choke point of trade between East Asia and Europe, it was already the go-to intermediate point for traders in Asia and Europe to ship their goods to first, before transferring them onto other vessels going in both directions. But following Singapore's independence from Malaysia in 1965, the government took significant steps to exacerbate this geographic advantage even further. The government of the post-independence era knew that Singapore's geographic location granted it the potential to become a major aviation hub as well, with high layover demand between East Asia, Australia, India, West Asia, and Europe. And so, in the late 1970s, they started painstakingly building out and designing the new Changi International Airport to have as many amenities as physically possible. That way, layover travelers flying between East and West would be attracted to layover through Singapore over anywhere else nearby, not only because of its natural location and safe and stable political environment, but also because of all of its nice amenities that made traveling through Singapore a desired destination in its own right. Changi International Airport was opened in 1981, and it has since cemented Singapore as a major global passenger layover hub, as well as a major air cargo hub. It's also extremely useful for assisting with the Port of Singapore's maritime operations as well, because it can easily and quickly facilitate constantly moving ship crew members in and out from all around the world, which further contributes to Singapore's advantages towards being the world's leading point for cargo transshipment. And then, to multiply all of these advantages even further, Singapore's government realized early on that their position along the busiest maritime choke point in the world, with the world's highest density of maritime traffic, gave them an enormous amount of potential customers passing by who would be in need of fuel. And so, Singapore essentially transformed themselves into the world's largest gas station in order to service all of that traffic. Companies in Singapore are able to import, refine, and store enormous volumes of ship fuels like marine diesel, also called bunker, and then sell those fuels to ships passing by between Asia and Europe, much like a gas station on land would, but on a vastly larger scale. Singapore is by far the largest refueling port for ships anywhere in the world today, and it supplies roughly 5 times as much fuel to the maritime industry as the second largest refueling port in the world does at Rotterdam in the Netherlands. Because of this huge advantage in its own internal stability and business friendliness, thanks to the guiding hand of Lee Kuan Yew and the PAP, Singapore managed to acquire the outside investment needed to rapidly build up its own domestic oil refinery capabilities to service the maritime traffic passing by. And it eventually got to the point where today, Singapore routinely ranks among the top 15 countries worldwide by oil refinery capacity, despite its small population and land size. And this is key to understanding how Singapore has managed to become so overpowered today. Singapore has 3 major oil refineries today. One owned by ExxonMobil, which is the 11th largest single refinery on the planet. Another one owned by Shell, and another one owned by Singapore's own state-owned Singapore Refining Company. Together, they enable Singapore to refine roughly 1.4 million barrels of crude oil a day into refined, finished end products like gasoline or marine diesel. And because Singapore itself is so small and hardly anybody there drives a car, since mostly everyone just takes the public transportation, Singapore itself has little need of the enormous amounts of refined petroleum products that they create, leaving them to export and sell the vast majority of it they create. This is all how, despite Singapore having 0 natural resources of its own, Singapore has nonetheless still managed to become the 5th largest exporter of refined petroleum products on the planet, just slightly behind Russia, who's often considered to be among the global energy superpowers. Singapore's high education levels have also enabled its human capital to rapidly increase in value with time as their people have developed more and more in-demand skills, which has attracted even more foreign investment to make use of that high-skilled human capital, which has enabled the country to excel at more value-added businesses than just refined petroleum as well, including semiconductor manufacturing, electronics, pharmaceuticals, and industrial equipment. And because so many goods pass through Singapore on their way to other places between Europe and Asia, roughly 1/5 of all the cargo containers in the world will pass through Singapore's port on an annual basis. And it's because of all of these clever policies combined with Singapore's natural geographic advantages that have enabled the country's economy and development to absolutely explode since their independence from Malaysia in 1965. Foreign investment has poured into Singapore like few other countries in the world, as they have proven themselves to be a stable, secure, and profitable place to invest in within a highly strategic corner of the world for decades now. As of 2022, Singapore ranked 5th in the entire world for the amount of total foreign direct investment stock present in the country, valued at roughly $2.37 trillion, remaining only behind the Netherlands, the UK, China, and the US globally. And foreign investors keep choosing Singapore over almost anywhere else because, in 2023, Singapore received the 2nd largest net inflows of new foreign direct investment in the world, remaining only behind that of the United States itself. This is all how their economy has ballooned in size hundreds of times over, from only a paltry $970 million in 1965 to a colossal $550 billion today, only 60 years later, and how it's become the world's 26th largest economy, despite being smaller in size and population than New York City. And it's all been possible because of how massively attractive and stable a place the PAP has made it to invest in throughout their decades of continuous control and guided policies. Most ironically of all, of course, is the fact that Singapore's economy today is even larger than the whole of Malaysia's economy is, the country that forcefully expelled Singapore against their wishes to die on their own back in 1965. But rather than die, Singapore's survival instinct was so strong that it managed to not only overcome the odds stacked against it, but eclipsed them to become the most overpowered state in Asia and possibly even the world. But the sheer scale of Singapore's economic successes can be measured in other ways as well. Besides for reinvesting huge sums of the money they began generating into the people of Singapore through their world-class education and healthcare systems and apartment and public transportation building sprees, the Singaporean government also decided to establish a series of sovereign wealth funds to secure the economic future of the country as well. The country's state-owned investment company, Temasek Holdings, currently controls an amount of assets under management estimated at about $630 billion. On top of that, the country's Central Provident Fund, that savings and pension fund that all Singaporean workers are forced to save a percentage of their incomes in, currently has assets valued at around $397 billion. And on top of both of those funds, the government also has another even larger sovereign wealth fund that they simply call the GIC. The GIC invests in international equities, bonds, real estate, and cash. And though it does not disclose its total holdings, a data firm known as Global SWF has recently estimated that the fund's holdings are likely somewhere around $769 billion all in. Add all of the three funds together, and Singapore's total sovereign wealth fund assets today in 2025 are probably somewhere around $1.8 trillion. An absolutely enormous war chest for the country's future. It ranks Singapore's sovereign wealth funds as the third largest in the entire world today, behind only the giant funds under the control of the UAE and China. And it also means that Singapore's sovereign wealth fund controls assets valued at more than three times the entire country's annual GDP. It also means that, astonishingly, if all of Singapore's sovereign wealth funds were divided evenly amongst all of Singapore's residents right now, they would each be given approximately $300,000. A tremendous national inheritance that the Singaporean government has established for them with its decades of tremendous forward-looking policies. For a long time, Singapore's status as the financial epicenter of Asia was rivaled and eclipsed by Hong Kong. But over the last few years, Singapore has managed to overcome Hong Kong in numerous ways as political repression in Hong Kong enforced by the Chinese Communist Party from the mainland has significantly increased, which has led to a large amount of capital flight fleeing from Hong Kong for the higher perceived sense of safety and security in Singapore. Singapore now has more foreign direct investment than Hong Kong does, and it receives even more of it with every passing year. As recently as 2017, international asset and wealth management firms in Singapore had only $2.4 trillion of total assets under their management, which was only about three-fourths of Hong Kong's total at the time of $3.1 trillion. But since then, Singapore's total assets under management have grown rapidly to more than $4.1 trillion as of 2023, compared to Hong Kong's $3.99 trillion. Which means that recently, Singapore has even overtaken Hong Kong to be the leading city in Asia by assets under management and asset and wealth management firms, which is why Singapore is now most often considered to be the leading financial hub of Asia, and the third most important center of global finance behind only London and New York. Hong Kong's political troubles over the past decade have therefore transferred much of its economic influence and power over to Singapore instead. But it also doesn't hurt that English as a language, like it has been in Hong Kong, is extremely dominant and commonplace in Singapore, too. After the country's independence from Malaysia, the PAP authorities decided to keep and reinforce English in Singapore as the country's primary language, in order to maximize the economic benefits and the foreign direct investment potential. It's since gotten to the point today where Singapore is by far the most English-proficient country in Asia, and the second most English-proficient country in the world out of countries where English is not the native language, according to the English Proficiency Index. Around half of all Singaporeans speak English as their primary language at home today, while a whopping 96% of the Singaporean population speak English fluently, which is a higher percentage of fluent English speakers than even in the United States. And all of that greatly helps Singapore's potential at attracting businesses and investment from abroad, on top of all of their other advantages that I've already covered. Now, in order to defend all of the enormous levels of wealth that are concentrated in Singapore today, surrounded by much larger and much poorer, potentially envious nations, Singapore has also spent decades heavily reinvesting the money it's earned as the world's gas station and as a major finance and advanced manufacturing hub into building out an incredibly powerful and capable armed forces that can adequately defend the country's sovereignty. But part of Singapore's drive to military supremacy in its neighborhood was also driven by the country's early survival instinct and its fears of critical overdependence on its neighbors. Singapore was and still remains highly overdependent on imports of its water and food supply, as the country has zero freshwater resources of its own and only limited amounts of arable land for its 6 million people. Singapore still imports more than 60% of its entire water supply and about 50% of its food supply just from Malaysia, the country who forcefully ejected them and then had to suffer through the humiliation of watching Singapore grow even wealthier than them without them. From time to time, Malaysia has weaponized this leverage they have over Singapore by sometimes threatening to halt their water and food deliveries or to increase prices, which has frequently led to drama flaring up between them and even nearly came to war more than 20 years ago back in 2002. In order to reduce their overdependence on Malaysia for their water and food, the Singaporean government has poured cash into diversifying its water supply through new water desalination plants, rainwater recatchment and storage facilities, and wastewater treatment and recycling plants. However, nearly all of Singapore's water that is still imported from Malaysia, which represents about 60% of Singapore's total water supply, comes from the nearby Johor River under the terms of a 99-year-long water supply treaty that was signed in 1962, just before Singapore initially joined with Malaysia. That treaty is now set to expire in 2061, just 36 years from today. And fearing the worst, the PAP's stated goal is to achieve full Singaporean water self-sufficiency by the year before that, in 2060, through more desalination, wastewater treatment, recycling, and rainwater recapture. But for decades, the Singaporean military was also created with the potential threat of Malaysia in mind, and Malaysia's ability to effectively sever most of Singapore's water supply. If Malaysia decided to try and retake Singapore to shut down its water supply as leverage during a dispute, then Singapore would need to react decisively and quickly in order to gain strategic depth and to avoid a long, protracted conflict. Singapore's northern border is only 28 kilometers away from its southernmost border, meaning that there's little space between Singapore's borders and the country's most critical population centers and assets. Knowing that their population was also a fraction of both Malaysia's and Indonesia's, Singapore's leaders knew early on that their only hope of not getting numerically overwhelmed during a regional conflict would be by establishing an army of conscripts, and by requiring that all Singaporean men serve time in the armed forces. All men in Singapore today are required to serve 2 years of mandatory full-time service in the armed forces, which gives the country a pool of hundreds of thousands of men in the reserves to call up for military service during a national emergency. However, calling up hundreds of thousands of Singapore's workers during a conflict would be a significant part of the country's relatively small labor force, which would devastate the economy and scare off foreign investors, the lifeblood of the country's economy if it went on for too long. And thus, Singapore's need to win any conflict quickly and decisively if it were to ever happen, and to ideally deter anybody from ever even thinking about launching a war against them in the first place. In order to deter Malaysia to maintain a credible enough threat that they could quickly secure their water supply from the Johor River and advance onto the Malaysian capital at Kuala Lumpur during a conflict, Singapore has invested heavily into a major mechanized armor force. The country now has 170 main battle tanks in its arsenal, which is 3 times as many tanks as Malaysia has. While Singapore also maintains an inventory of 940 mechanized infantry fighting vehicles, compared to Malaysia's 635 total. To put that into perspective, Singapore, a country of only 6 million people, has more tanks in service in their armed forces than the entire United Kingdom currently has. And Singapore's outsized inventory of tanks are far from the only reason why Malaysia or other countries would be deterred from ever trying to attack little Singapore. The city-state has also been able to afford to build out a very modern and capable air force, with 59 American-made F-16 fighters, another 40 F-15 fighters, and most notably, they've placed orders to purchase at least 20 state-of-the-art F-35 fighters from the United States as well, which will make them the very first and so far only country in the whole of Southeast Asia that'll be equipped with them. That fact alone will make the Singaporean Air Force the most capable and advanced in all of Southeast Asia. But even without the F-35s, the Singaporean Air Force still has just as many fighter aircraft in its fleet as both Malaysia and Indonesia do combined. It's two much larger neighbors. Adding in the F-35s and all of Singapore's advanced service to air defenses means that in any potential conflict with its neighbors, Singapore would almost certainly be able to maintain aerial supremacy, which further disincentivizes anyone from ever really even thinking about trying, and especially disincentivizes Malaysia from ever seriously threatening to really apply their leverage over Singapore's water and food supply. And even if a conflict were to take place, the PAP has also guided Singapore's development to transform itself into a fortress if the need ever arose. Two of the primary highways running through Singapore were designed to be quickly transformed into runways for military aircraft should the country's air bases be neutralized during wartime. While every home and apartment in the country that's been built recently after 1997 has been mandated to have personal bomb shelters included in them. But it's the Singaporean Navy that truly makes the city-state the most preeminent military power in Southeast Asia today. Singapore operates a naval fleet today that includes six modern German and Swedish-built diesel-powered attack submarines, and has another two more on order that are currently being constructed. When they're finished and Singapore has eight modern attack submarines, the city-state will have more submarines than both Malaysia and Indonesia do combined, which will further increase Singapore's status as the most powerful submarine force located anywhere in Southeast Asia, despite its small size. In addition to the submarines, the Singaporean Navy also has six frigates, an additional six more frigates that are currently on order, six corvettes, and eight littoral mission vessels, which combined with the submarines easily classes the Singaporean Navy as the most powerful in Southeast Asia, and places it about on a par with the Royal Australian Navy in terms of both fleet size and capabilities. And that's comparing a city-state's navy to a continent-state's navy. All in, the Singaporean military budget as of 2024 is approximately $15 billion, and the country spends about 2.77% of its total GDP on the military, which places little Singapore within the top 23 highest military budgets globally, and puts Singapore's military spending about on a par with Turkey, a country with 14 times as many people. Perhaps more importantly, Singapore spends even more on its military than both of its much larger neighbors do combined, Malaysia and Indonesia. As a result of all of this, with Singapore controlling the most capable and well-funded armed forces in all of Southeast Asia, despite being the region's smallest country in terms of territory, Singapore is often regarded as the most heavily militarized country in the world today, with more soldiers, tanks, aircraft, and warships per square kilometer of territory than any other country in the world, which further lends credence to Singapore's status as the most overpowered country in Asia, and possibly in the entire world. The military's massively outsized power also sends a very clear signal to the lifeblood of the Singaporean economy, the foreign investors, that their investments and capital stored in Singapore will not only be safe, protected from within, but will also be safe and protected from beyond as well, further solidifying Singapore as an ultra-safe location to invest and to do business in. But the scale of the military is not only intended to send this message to foreign investors and to keep Singapore safe and stable from potential regional aggressors. It's also designed to try and reduce the risk of the greatest looming threat to Singapore's future of all from ever happening, the growing risk of a war erupting between the United States and China over Taiwan, and them then forcing Singapore to painfully choose a side between them. For decades, Singapore has tried to carefully balance its relations between both of the global superpowers in order to court each of their massive amounts of capital available for investment. On the one hand, China is the largest source of both imports and exports for Singapore. Nearly all of China's enormous imports of oil and gas from the Persian Gulf flows directly by Singapore, while virtually all of China's manufactured products going to Europe flow in the other direction right by Singapore as well. Ethnic Chinese Singaporeans make up around 3/4 of the whole country's population, and out of all of the developed countries in the world, Singapore's population by far holds the friendliest overall views of China today. In June of 2024, the Pew Research Center found that 67% of Singaporeans held a favorable view of China, and that 63% of Singaporeans held confidence in the leadership of Xi Jinping, both significantly higher than in any other developed country measured. About $156 billion worth of money from mainland China and Hong Kong are also currently invested in Singapore. But that's still second to the even more massive $428 billion that's currently invested in Singapore from the United States. According to data from the American Chamber of Commerce in Singapore, U.S.-based companies currently employ more than 200,000 people in Singapore, which is about 6% of the entire country's labor force. Singapore simultaneously hosts the headquarters of Chinese firms like TikTok and the regional headquarters of ByteDance and Alibaba, along with the regional headquarters of American firms like Apple, Alphabet, Meta, and Microsoft. Singapore is trying to maintain as much of a neutral, balanced position between Beijing and Washington as possible, but it's growing increasingly difficult for them to continue. Since 1990, Singapore has maintained a memorandum of understanding with the United States that allows the U.S. military to access Singapore's naval and air bases that provide logistical support to U.S. naval vessels and aircraft. Singapore's Changi Naval Base can, and frequently does, accommodate U.S. aircraft carriers for logistical support as they travel between the Pacific and Indian Ocean theaters. Despite that, and all of their purchases of U.S. military hardware, however, Singapore maintains close military ties with China as well, including an active defense agreement, joint military exercises with the People's Liberation Army, and a visiting forces agreement. In the worst-case scenario, then, if a conflict erupts between the United States and China in the near future over the status of Taiwan, both Beijing and Washington will be likely to try and pressure Singapore into choosing a side between them because of Singapore's strategic location and military potential. Singapore controls the gates through which virtually all of China's imports of oil and gas flow through, and China will do whatever it takes to keep those gates open, while America will do whatever it can to seal them shut in a conflict scenario. If the U.S. pressured Singapore to apply economic sanctions against China, then Chinese capital and money would rush itself out of the country and crush the economy. And on the other hand, if Singapore refused to cooperate with American sanctions, then America could just impose restrictions on Singapore's own access to the U.S. dollar financial system, which is the backbone of Singapore's banking and finance industries that would also crush the economy. It's a horrifying prospect for the country that has so successfully ridden the wave of globalization over the past 60 years since it was ejected against its will from Malaysia. Indeed, it has been the unprecedented era of openness, connectivity, and free access to the seas in the modern era of globalization that has enabled Singapore to grow so wildly successful and overpowered relative to its size. And in the future, the potential breakdown of that same era of globalization and the increasingly confrontational relationship between Singapore's two largest investors will present the greatest challenge to the city-state yet in its relatively short history of independence. Singapore's ability to maintain its status as the most overpowered state in Asia will be tested like it never has before, and the PAP's ability to guide the country through the typhoon ahead will show whether or not the next 60 years of Singapore's history will be as wildly successful as its past 60 years have been. But the PAP has carefully guided the country through enormous existential challenges before, and I believe that it is as well prepared as any other power to handle whatever lies ahead. Now, there's a lot of data that goes into producing these kinds of videos. Whether it's visually showing the scale of Singapore and other countries from an economic size perspective, detailing how Singapore and Hong Kong's assets under management stack up, or showing you how the air forces of Singapore, Malaysia, and Indonesia all compare with one another, the ability to actually visualize raw data like this on the map instead of just reading about it in text format is exactly what makes learning about these kinds of complicated geopolitical subjects so fascinating to me. And it's why the Exploring Data Visually course is one of my favorite courses that I've ever taken with this video sponsor, Brilliant. They start out by teaching some real bare-bones fundamentals through interactive exercises and straightforward explanations. Then as you progress, they bring these small concepts together into the bigger process. And soon enough, you have a decent grasp of what originally seemed like a daunting subject. And the same goes for all the other subjects they cover too, from calculus to AI to computer science, advanced physics, geometry, and much more. I think that Brilliant is perfect for the kind of person who genuinely loves understanding new things, as they get you to the level where you can apply the concepts you learn into your everyday life. And they also make learning super practical, too. Their courses break down into short segments of only about 15 minutes, so you can easily use their app to make steady progress in learning while you're commuting or have some free time. So, if you're the type of person who loves learning new things, you can try out everything Brilliant has to offer for free for a full 30 days by clicking the button here on your screen right now, or by visiting brilliant.org/reallifelore, or by clicking the link down below in the description. And best of all, you'll also get 20% off of an annual premium subscription. It's an incredible way to help support my channel and learn some cool new things at the same time. And as always, thank you so much for watching.